I'm Afshin Ratansi, and you're watching Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from Dubai in the heart of the Middle East. And if you've been watching the show since we started, we've been charting the end of the good cop, bad cop, World Bank, IMF consensus that Washington has leveraged around the world. Arguably, conflicts over Ukraine and Taiwan are now slamming the doors shut on the post-1945 era of economic hitmen that comprised NATO nation lenders, corporations, the CIA, and those who fostered global war, debt and famine. One of the hitmen and someone who blew the whistle on them is John Perkins. He allegedly advised the World Bank, the IMF, the US Treasury Department, Fortune 500 corporations, governments all around the world. His best-selling Confessions of an Economic Hitman is now in a 2023 updated third edition. He's on Bainbridge Island over the water from Seattle in Washington State. Thank you so much for coming back on Going Underground, John. I've got to say, it's very different, very updated, full of new information if anyone thinks it's just the old Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Just remind us, before we start, why it became required reading in the Global South to be able, amongst elites even, to understand what happened in the Global South these past few decades, where famine and war and vulnerability has been rife, seemingly in NATO nation media blamed on those peoples living in those countries rather than something else.
Well, yes, I think, Afshin, it's great to be with you again, incidentally. And, you know, people in the Global South, I get so many messages from them. And when I go and visit and speak in places in South America and elsewhere, I hear that they knew this sort of thing was going on. But to actually have it be exposed and in writing by someone who was there on the ground doing these nefarious things, which I did, and to have someone admit to doing them and now spend the rest of his life trying to turn that around is very gratifying to them. So the book is very, very popular. It's been, I think, 38 languages now, sold over 2 million copies. It's and people in many, many countries say, you know, the United States needs to be called to reckoning on this. And now, of course, this new book deals with China's economic hitmen, who are doing pretty much the same thing. They've got a different story to tell. They've got a new marketing technique, which is very, very effective. But it's just basically the same story. Their economic hitmen learn from our failures and our successes. And they're doing a much more efficient job than we ever did.
And do you expect to be attacked by omission in NATO nation media press? Or will they like this one? Because you do attack China, which is a kind of trope. Many people doubt the Uyghur story. People can see our interview with another story designed by the kinds of forces that you've described for decades to destabilize countries. How do you expect the response to this updated edition, or to some instruction manual, how to destroy developing world countries, to others, how to save them?
Well, my hope is that people will really look at what I think is the major theme of the book, and that is the economic hitman strategy in China and the United States is taking us to the precipice of self-destruction of the world as we know it. And life as we know it on this planet. You know, we can talk about climate change and income inequality and species extinction. Those are problems, but they're not the problem. They are symptoms of this death economy that's based on short-term maximization of profits, period. And it's not working. Trickle-down economics does not work. And so, you know, the book is about how do we create a life economy that pays people to clean up pollution, to regenerate destroyed environments, to recycle, to develop technologies like, you know, wind and solar and non-carbon emitting forms of energy.
I know. I mean,
so
even
on.
At the end of the book, there are exercises, there are things for schools, there are education. How do you expect this stuff to happen, given if you reach any level of power, based on the rest of the text in the book, you may be killed, overthrown, if you get a democratic mandate, or they will print stories against you, they will use all these... you've got one side saying, whatever you try, they will destroy you, and the other one saying, try for a better world.
Well, you know, I realize I'm fighting probability. But history is based on people who fought probability successfully. You know, in 1774, the concept in the United States, in America, it wasn't the United States yet, was that the British were indefensible, were indefeatable. They were invincible. They couldn't be beaten. And, you know, George Washington stands up before the Continental Congress and says, remembers how 20 years earlier he was at the Battle of the Monongahela during the French and Indian War, where the biggest, most powerful British army was wiped out, and its General Braddock was killed, and all the major officers were killed by a handful of French and Indians. And Washington says, well, listen, they're not invincible. All we got to do is hide behind trees, go against probability, come up with a new system. My hope is that the probability is that we're going to go on doing this, and we're going to continue to create problems, more severe hurricanes, more severe climate change, et cetera. But I believe that we can go against probability, and because history is written by people who oppose probability and do something, come up with a new idea, a new perception, a new approach. And that's what this book is about, Afshin, is how we can all come together. You know, think about it. Everybody says, well, China and the United States can never agree to do something like this to fight climate change, et cetera. But if there was a UFO hovering above us and aliens were threatening to attack us, what would China and the United States do? They'd probably come together. History would say that they would come together.
It does say I'm not saying you're a complete clairvoyant, but this is a direct quote from the updated edition, presumably written in the early days of the Ukraine conflict. In the long run, Russia's invasion of Ukraine may strengthen China's position as the leader in the movement to reduce the U.S.'s influence. So you were saying directly that China and Russia would move closer together after what happened in Ukraine. Are we seeing that now? Is the Chinese balloon story an emblem of this fact?
Well, yes. And of course, we're also seeing India and Turkey and much of the lower and middle income countries, if not siding with Russia completely, at least not siding with NATO and the United States either. They're not going against Russia there. And so, yes, we're seeing that China is being strengthened in this process. But the fact of the matter is China had already taken over much of the lower income countries. Their investments in the last few years have in these countries, the aid that they've given, if you want to call it aid, the loans are greater than the loans of all other countries, including the United States combined. I mean, they've been making huge headway. And I think the point here, to a large degree, Afshin, is that we need to be aware of both countries, that both countries, the United States and China, are in a competition, a race toward disaster. You know, they're taking us into what I call, and what a lot of economists are calling, a death economy, an economic system that's consuming and polluting itself into extinction.
I mean, you talk about Indonesia. You were one of the hitmen after the great non-aligned movement ideas of Sukarno, before perhaps a million, perhaps more, were killed at the behest of the CIA-led coup there. In a sense, that reflects that non-alignment. It's different now. There are cycles to these things. In the book, you talk about cycles. I don't know what you thought of Seymour Hersh, who we interviewed on this program, and his report on the Nord Stream attack. So there are times when Washington will use debt as an instrument of war, with interest payments impoverishing the developing world countries. And then there are kinetic times like Vietnam or Iraq. Just tell us a bit about these cycles and whether the Ukraine situation is a kinetic one or is something that will also be technocratic and to do with debt, some people say, of the whole of Western Europe to U.S. gas, liquid natural gas.
Well, yeah, you know, so after the failure of the war in Vietnam, failure from the United States standpoint, at least strategically speaking, it wasn't a failure if you happen to be a major investor in military industrial industries. They saw the war as quite a success, actually. They made a lot of money, in other words, but it was a failure strategically. After that, it was decided that military might wasn't the way to go. That we needed to go with economic hitmen. We needed to essentially control countries through debt rather than the military. And this went on for many years, and it particularly revved up after 1991 when the Soviet Union dissolved, when the United States was the only world superpower. But during this period of time, those involved in the, what we call the military-industrial complex, the ones who make the weapons, the big companies that, that make the airplanes, the Lockheed Martins and Boeings and so on and so forth, they were not happy with that situation. And they put a lot of pressure on the Carter administration. And so when 9/11 happened, we went back into that cycle. This was a tremendous, great excuse to rev up the military side of our economy. And that's what happened after 9/11. And in some respects, the Ukraine war is giving us the opportunity to rev that up even more. And it's certainly happening. We're going in that direction in a big way. You know, I've tried, and I know you've had Greg Palast and Seymour Hersh and others on this program who are very good investigative reporters. It seems to be impossible to find out how much of this aid that we're giving to Ukraine is actually in the form of debt. There can't be any doubt that some of it, at least, probably a lot of it, is in the form of debt. But it's hard to tell, because what the American people, what the world is told, is that we're giving all this aid to Ukraine. The one thing we do know is that that is providing a lot of profits to the military industries in the United States. There's no question that they're making a lot of money off this. Who owes that money? It remains to be seen.
I mean, given that you were working with these institutions, with big corporations, you don't sometimes have nightmares thinking that people are reading your work, including the new updated edition, and reversing it in their heads to use it as an investment strategic Bible, and therefore pick out what to make money off whilst the corpses pile up in Ukraine. Thousands, hundreds of thousands, mainly.
Yeah, there's a long... Long history of this. You know, all we got to do is look at religions to see how, the word of Jesus or Muhammad or any other, the prophets, the guiding principles behind religions, how their words have been used to fight wars, to incite wars, and used to make money.
Okay,
too.
But we're not comparing you directly to them. I'm going to add to that.
All I can say, let's make that clear.
Yeah, you better make that clear.
What I can say is, whether you're Seymour Hersh or Greg Palast or whoever you are, as you write these things, I'm very aware that these things can be turned around and used against me, or even used against the United States. And that's certainly not my intent, but my intent always is to support democracy. And I think democracy requires that we have a very critical analysis of everything that we're doing and always strive to get better. And right now we know we've got a system that's failing us. There's climate change, there's income inequality globally. We are on the brink of a major change in what it means to be humans on this planet. The question is, are we going to change? Is the planet going to change us because we're abusing our system, because we're overemphasizing materialistic consumption and short-term profits? Or can we turn this around and transform the death economy into a life economy?
John Perkins, I'll stop you there. More from the author of the best-selling Confessions of an Economic Hitman after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the best-selling confessions of an economic hitman author and former economic hitman himself, John Perkins. You know, although media restrictions are not as bad where I'm speaking to you from, if I tell you and remind you what the World Bank standard statements are, the World Bank promotes long-term economic development and poverty reduction. So there's an answer to that one. The IMF promotes global macroeconomic and financial stability and provides policy advice. Again and again, and you haven't changed since the first edition, you just say the World Bank and the IMF don't do that. I mean, U.S. State Department, Perkins claims the U.S. National Security Agency recruited him to be an economic hitman. It appears to be a total fabrication. That's from the U.S. State Department in 2006. How do you respond? I mean, there's been so many years of this that you've given up on it now.
Well, you know, the New York Times did a major article vetting that, looking at that, at exactly what the State Department said, and you know, totally disagreed with the State Department. It was interesting to me. That was a website the State Department put up, and I was the only person on the website. It was called the Misinformation website, and it sold a lot of books for me, I got to say. And I always wondered, so why are they saying this? Because it's obviously not true. They said the only job of the National Security Agency is to encode and decode messages. Well, we know it's a huge agency, probably the biggest spy agency in the United States, maybe in the world. It does a lot more than encoding and decoding messages. And everybody knew that. And I had a television producer who came to the United States several times to interview me. He was from Athens. He did a program in Athens. It was like the 60 minutes of Greece, I was told. And he, at one point, he asked me, he said, do you know why the State Department did this? And I said, I have no idea. It's selling a lot of books, and it's obviously a fabrication. He said, well, I know. He said, after I did the first program with you, the U.S. ambassador in Athens called me into the office and chewed me out. And he said, you know, you put me in a very, very difficult position, because now all these people are reading this book, other diplomats, and they're coming into my office and saying, is it true? What's your position on this book? And he said, I go back to the State Department and ask, well, what is our position on this book? And he said, I'm sure diplomats around the world were having the same problem. And so the State Department had to come up with a statement so that their diplomats could just say, well, I don't have a comment on it personally, but here's our official response. And it was really interesting to me, Ashim, because it did sell a lot of books for me. I think it accomplished the opposite of what they wanted to accomplish.
You quote from WikiLeaks. I mean, Julian Assange has been on this show. General Michael Flynn, he's been on this show. And I got to say, Assange and Flynn virtually annihilated after they talked about what was really going on away from the press releases of the State Department, away from arguable lies in so-called mainstream corporate media. Assange, of course, arguably being tortured, according to the UN rapporteur in London at the moment. This updated edition, and people must be wondering, and people ask the question, and you address it in this edition, how is it you are alive, given that you have blown the whistle on some of the most horrific crimes that, in a way, are emblematic of worse crimes, that you say in the book, as one country after another in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, is impoverished deliberately as strategy by the United States. In this book, you say you were targeted, perhaps, your health, perhaps, to stop you at the UN, and you have fears for your family.
Well, yes. So when I first started to write the book, a long time ago, I contacted other people who'd had jobs like mine, and the jackals, the people who go in if the economic hitmen are unsuccessful and overthrow governments or supervise the overthrow of governments and sometimes even assassinate their leaders, as what happened to Allende in Chile and Arbenz in Guatemala and Mossadegh in Iran and on and on. The United States has admitted to many of these things. I contacted some of these people and immediately I received anonymous phone calls threatening my life and threatening the life of my infant daughter. So, and at the same time, I was offered a very lucrative consulting job with Stone & Webster Engineering Company, who had been a major competitor of mine when I was chief economist at Charles T. Maine. And I'd quit that job and was writing this book. And they offered me an extremely lucrative consulting position, provided I didn't write the book. They knew I was working on the book. So I stopped. But then after 9/11, I knew I had to write the book. And I'm not saying there's any direct connection here at all, but there isn't. But when I went to Ground Zero and looked down on that smoldering pit, I knew I had to come clean on what I'd done. And I decided this time I wouldn't tell anybody. I wouldn't contact anyone else. I would write a confession. I wrote the whole thing in secret and then got it in the hands of a good New York agent who got it in the hands of publishing houses. And at that point, I figured it's my insurance policy, because, you know, anyone who might not like what I wrote, particularly in the government, would know that if something strange happened to me, the book would sell a lot more copies than the 2 million that it did sell. I went forward and did that.
As regards Jackals and economic hitmen, then, what do you think the strategy is, based on all your experience, as regards OPEC? It was widely reported that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates didn't answer Biden's phone call when, after what happened in Ukraine, they were, as per usual, some might say, and as in your book you imply, were told, look, increase output, reduce the global prices of crude, and they didn't do it. Will it be easy for them to have another jackal economic hitman strategy against Mohammed bin Salman and MBZ of the UAE?
No, it won't be easy today because of China and because the world has changed so much. Amongst other things, many of the Muslim countries are very upset at us for what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq. They don't see us as friendly to Muslim countries. And China has become the major power in so much of the world that no longer are we looked at as the great protector. These countries know that we can't protect them against China. They know that we can't, that even Russia at this point, though, despite what we're doing in Ukraine, this threat is very real, and they're seeing that the United States is overextended.
Mean the jackal, John? So if there's no economic hitman, does that mean the jackal? I'm speaking to you from Dubai. Are the Americans coming for us?
I think at this point it's less likely than in the past. But certainly, these people now have some pretty good ways to protect themselves against jackals. The jackals have been notoriously good at taking out governments in countries that have fairly weak governments. They're not so good at taking out countries where you have a very strong government, like Saudi Arabia. The Middle East at this point is a very different place from what it was back when I helped strike that deal in the early and mid-1970s.
Well,
the whole world is in place.
Well, what about back home in the United States? Because Joe Biden talks a lot about things that are happening abroad. Back in the United States, the big story for a while was this balloon. And then belatedly, I think it was to public pressure, arguably, people started talking about infrastructure, the Ohio Rail disaster. I know you say that the Ukraine war again is diverting the U.S. from strengthening relationships with global partners. But at the same time, why is infrastructure in the state that it is in the United States? And how is it related to this global economic hitman jackal strategy from Washington?
Well, because the United States, corporations can't make nearly as much money off doing infrastructure projects in the United States as they can make off doing infrastructure projects in other countries. So when an economic hitman goes in and convinces the president of a Latin American or an African country to take a huge loan from the World Bank that they have to use to hire U.S. corporations to build infrastructure projects in their country, The company that builds the infrastructure projects, the U.S. corporation, makes huge profits. And, of course, the military-industrial complex does not benefit from infrastructure projects in the United States the way that they benefit from what goes on in other countries. So there's a lot of pressure at the various highest levels of our government through lobbyists and consultants and advisors to expand all of our overseas efforts. And the other side of that is that as we expand these overseas efforts, we are also aligning ourselves with countries that have resources that our corporations want: oil, copper, cobalt. Today, we're looking to take better control of the lithium which is, you know, so important to the to the green economy. And China has essentially, I think they control just about 90% of the lithium in the world. The
people can watch our Luis Arce interview, president of Bolivia. It didn't work out so well for Washington when after Evo Morales, where lithium is, of course, in Bolivia. We don't really have much time to be able to talk about Noriega, who surprisingly comes out nicer than one might expect in the new updated edition, given the demonization or specific demonization of him in Panama. But when it comes to Panama, we know Zelensky was named in the Panama Papers. That doesn't seem to be talked about much nowadays. You say in this book that since the first edition, you become shocked by how blatant, defiant and merciless the NATO nation, the banks, these big banks of the NATO nations are. You talk about the corrupt LIBOR interest rate setting. And you don't think much of the $10 billion fine on JP Morgan Chase, Barclays, Bank of Scotland, UBS, pleaded guilty, Deutsche Bank, $2.5 billion. You weren't satisfied the fact that all these banks were corrupt? Admittedly corrupt. They can't sue me on that one.
What do you mean I wasn't satisfied?
With the fine, the levels of fine. They paid their dues.
Oh, well,
they're clean now.
Well, isn't it funny that banks get fined, but banks don't commit crimes. Banks don't get put in prison. Banks don't, they get fined. But the people that actually committed the crimes, the ones who made the decisions, they go scot-free. Those are the CEOs, people in high positions in these banks. I think that's horrific that corporations in the United States have the rights of individuals, but they don't have the responsibilities and they don't have to answer to the same laws. It's not the way a democracy should operate.
John Perkins, thank you. And the third and latest edition of Confessions of an Economic Hitman is out now if you're thinking of taking out an IMF loan. That's it for the final show of this season. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday, the 13th of May. But until then, we'll be broadcasting some of your favourite shows of the series. Meanwhile, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you very soon.